like to ask you if you can maybe explain to me, like quite concisely, what is the topic of this book? What's it all about?
Our problems today are really complex, and they require people from different backgrounds, professional backgrounds, cultural backgrounds, demographic backgrounds, to contribute different ideas so that we see the problem or the issue in front of us holistically. Because there's a risk with these complex problems that we get blinded by our own perspective and we miss either risks or opportunities or parts of the solution set which ultimately prove really critical. And it's why we need to get the right people at the right time helping us think about the fulsome nature of what's in front of us.
All right. Can you give me like a kind of historical background of this? Like, why does it appear?
Why does the phenomenon appear?
Yeah.
So there's been a trend towards specialization over the last decades, right? Many people are writing about this. And the idea there is that knowledge is changing so fast that for any of us to be an expert in a topic, we have to be clear about what we're trying to be an expert in. And that means that we tend to go very deep, but increasingly narrow and focused in our area of expertise. But at the same time, our problems have done the opposite. So problems are now very interconnected and multidisciplinary. So let me give an example. Supply chain, right? A big retailer in the past may have had operations experts to think about their supply chain. Now you need to think about not just the operations piece, not the cost of sourcing and the shipping and the legality, but you need to think about things like human rights. And you need to think about the reputational impact of human rights. And you need to think about the environmental impact of that supply chain. And the, again, reputational effects of your lack of environmental sustainability in the supply chain. And so suddenly, the area of business that could have been occupied by one discipline, you know, an operations, supply chain, efficiency, now has all of these other aspects to it. One that I forgot to mention is cyber, cybersecurity. So with the Internet of Things, you've got cyber risk built into almost every piece of your supply chain now. So the cyber experts have to be part of that. The political economists have to be part of it. You know, what's happening geopolitically that affects your supply chain? So it's an example of an area that can no longer be looked at through a single specialty lens because it would put that retailer at huge risk and competitive disadvantage if they didn't bring together the right people to examine their supply chain.
So there's also a need for more people, more lenses.
More lenses, yeah. Right? More lenses from different areas. If this isn't going to pick up, let me know. So yes, more people. And those people have to be really different from one another, which creates real challenges when they're trying to collectively address a topic because they might not know each other's jargon. They might have very different preferences for what the outcome looks like. They might have different incentives. And so it makes it really difficult for those people to work together, even if everyone agrees that each of those people is necessary, it doesn't make it any easier.
Okay. Are there like specific parts of the labor market? I don't know. I've directly translated that from Danish, but like the, you know, labor market? Is that what
yeah.
it's called?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I've never said that in English. Right. Is there like specific parts of the labor market where this phenomenon doesn't apply? You know, is there a difference between, let's say, like people working in a kindergarten and top executives in a, like a global corporation?
So very generally speaking, the more senior somebody is, the broader their remit, which means the more complexity is involved. But if you take the example of a kindergarten, they now have to be worried about issues that maybe previously weren't so important to them. Some of the health ramifications of, you know, pandemics, things like their
diets, no sugar for the kids.
Absolutely. Yeah. That, you know, I was even thinking like when my kids were very small, I never asked about the air conditioning in the preschool. But now with germs and the pandemic and all of this, now everyone's worried about what kind of air filters are in the preschool. I mean, I would have never thought to ask that, right? But now the preschool teachers have to answer those kinds of questions, which surely was not something they expected to do when they thought about taking care of four-year-olds. So yeah, I think it affects every area of the workforce, the labor market, the economy, but some are probably even more impacted than others.
And can you apply like your strategy, the strategies and like the theories you present in this book, can you apply them to all kinds of workplaces?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Because at its foundation, we're talking about humans, right? And so one of the most important aspects of smarter collaboration is trust. And that is the same, I don't care if you're talking about any culture, I don't care if you're talking about junior or senior, corporate or social, trust is absolutely foundational. And as you may have heard last night, we think about trust in two ways. One is competence trust. So if I really want to team up with you for problem solving or idea generation, I have to believe you know what you're talking about in your domain, not in mine, but in yours. And I have to believe that you have the right intentions, that you're not going to come into this project and take all the credit or steal my intellectual property or whatever, right? So I have to believe in your brain and I have to believe in your character. And the first one can be hard because the further apart you and I are in terms of what we know, the harder it is for us to evaluate each other's competence.
Sure.
So if you're coming in as a human rights expert and I'm coming in with a degree in supply chain management, how do we know?
Yeah.
Like, so, you know, the trust building can be really difficult sometimes, especially if it's not clear that we have a shared goal.
Okay, so defining the goal is...
Defining a goal is really critical.
Yeah.
And helping people understand why it's worth the investment. Because collaboration takes time and energy, sometimes money. And all of those costs are like startup costs. If you and I are going to work together, we have to really invest in the relationship, in learning each other's language, in developing the shared goal, all of those things. We have to do all of that right in the beginning. But what we produce may not get results for 3 months or 3 years. And so figuring out right up front what we expect to gain that's better together than what we could do on our own is really critical. And it's also really important to define some interim steps that will help us know we're making progress, right? There's a couple of reasons why that's important. One is that if we're not making progress, it allows us early on to change directions or to bring in different people or whatever it takes, but we can course correct early if we have clear milestones that we're trying to hit. The other reason is a very human reason that we need to do this. It's because lots of research shows that people are more motivated by small, frequent successes than they are by the promise of a big, big, big win down the road. And so in order to keep a collaboration effort on track, it's really critical that people believe in it, even when it's hard.
That's interesting, like the human factors, that they're not often thought about.
I think too many leaders operate as if their workforce and their stakeholders can be engineered. You put the right system and structure and process and rewards in place, and people will line up as if they're robots.
They won't.
Right? I mean, there's a whole field of behavioral economics where people have won Nobel Prizes demonstrating that human beings don't always operate as quote-unquote rational. And it's because what we purport as their incentives aren't the same things that always matter to them. Because we leave out things like ego. We leave out things like fear, the desire for certainty. Those are factors that are less easy to engineer, but often stand in the way of transformation.
Ambition also.
Ambition, that's a big one. The what's in it for me question.
I remember that,
And sometimes what's in it for me is more money, but the law of diminishing returns tells me that $100 for me doesn't really change my behavior, because thank God I'm pretty affluent. But $100 for somebody else really could make them behave differently. And money isn't always the best, it's actually infrequently the best motivator for people. But it's an easy one for managers to use. And so they keep using it even when it's not effective.
And who's, you know, setting the goals and defining the goals? Whose responsibility is it? Is that the management of a firm, the corporation, or is it like a team kind of effort?
Ideally, there are people at every part of the organization who can set these kinds of goals. And what's critical is that the top leaders have created the strategic framework so that everyone knows what we're trying to accomplish, and therefore can set lower level, more operational goals that are very, very, very closely aligned to those strategic goals. But what often happens in reality is that people optimize locally. They set up the thing that is closest to what they can control, and they set goals around that rather than taking the time and some of the risk to set broader strategic goals. So for example, in the chapter on performance management, we talk about how dangerous it is to set goals in functional silos, like just get your salespeople to sell as much as possible. Because they may end up selling the wrong thing, the easiest thing, the lowest profit thing, or even if they're doing all of the right things, they might get out ahead of the rest of the company and start selling things that you have no capacity to produce or install. That's a problem.
It's too fluffy, like too abstract.
It is. It's so, you know, I think the goal of getting people in sales to sell more sounds so logical. But is selling more really the strategic goal of the company? Not really. It's making it's doing sustainable business, which means it has to be not just higher revenue, but revenue in the right segments with customers that are satisfied and will continue to be your customers for the long term. Because it's really expensive to get new customers all the time, new. It's way more efficient and effective to take your existing customers and sell more to them because you end up doing more sophisticated work for them, not just selling three independent products, but three products that work together. If they're technology products, they have interoperability. They've got maybe more, like I talked about last night with the Drinks Co. They've got the ability to see more of the customer's business and create something customized when those three different product groups join up. So there's lots of ways that we want to be thinking about what a salesperson should do that's much more strategic than simply saying sell more.
Yeah.
But I work with lots of organizations that are simply measuring sales for the salespeople as if every euro they generate is an equal euro. And it's not. Right? You could have me generating 1 million euros, which costs 900,000 to sell. Because we spent so much on advertising and promotional budgets and taking the buyer out to lunch. My counterpart could have sold 1 million that only cost 200,000 to sell. And that million is even not just more profitable, but more strategic because they sold in a variety of products. That means that that buyer is kind of more locked in to our company for the long term. And yet his million and my million would count the exact same when it comes time for a bonus.
Yeah.
Why? Because it's easy.
Yeah.
So, you know, we have to admit that the easy, sometimes more readily quantified aspects of business are not the most strategic.
Okay. And maybe this is a like kind of stupid question, but I would like to hear like your thoughts about it. Who and what is this like the most beneficial for? Is it for the employees? Is it for the management, the customers, less of course the customers and the, like the business, the revenue, but yeah, who is it most important to?
That's a great question, actually. If done right, it benefits everyone.
Yeah.
And here's why. I was just reading this morning some of the latest research, which is just piling up, on how important it is for individual employees to feel like they've got a sense of purpose and meaning in their work. When we engage in smarter collaboration, it helps the meaning and purpose in several ways. Number one, it gives me the ability to play to my strengths. So maybe I am the real expert in smarter collaboration. And when somebody asks me to do something that's a finance issue, I can say, actually, no, I do organizational behavior. I do the human side of it. You do the finance piece. Let me bring in somebody and we'll join forces. But I play to my strengths and I don't have to pretend I'm something that I'm not. And again, lots of research suggests that when people play to their strengths, they're much more engaged. They are more sustainable. They're more motivated. Yeah. They're less likely to burn out.
Yeah.
So lots of reasons why playing to my strengths is helpful, and smarter collaboration allows people to do that. And at the same time, it allows people to take that narrow area that they're great at and use it to do something bigger, right? So then I'm not, you know, kind of just working on my little area. I'm working on my area that helps accomplish something much bigger. And it's that sense of purpose that I'm accomplishing a meaningful, high-value outcome that I couldn't do on my own. And, you know, the cliched example is the bricklayers, right? You know, are you building a wall or are you building a cathedral? The people building the cathedral are a whole lot more motivated. But at the end of the day, each of those bricklayers is still just putting one brick on top of the other.
Yeah.
You know, it's just one has a leader that's helping inspire them and help them understand why that brick wall is so crucial.
Yeah. Okay.
But sorry, to carry on.
It works.
You know, so it works as an effective motivator and... I mean, for the employees, there's also loads of benefits in terms of, you know, health benefits. When they're working collectively, they're less lonely. You know, we know all the research linking loneliness to heart attacks and suicide and horrible things. So, you know, it's better for the employees, but it is better for the customers. You know, they get a better service. They have a whole team of people looking out for their needs, as opposed to one individual who is only working to serve themselves. You know, it's also better for the broader stakeholder community because, you know, it's good for shareholders. It, you know, depending what the team is working on, it can be better for the environment. You're more likely to be creating an inclusive, community-oriented workforce. So there are benefits at lots of these different levels. I can't actually think of anyone who loses through smarter collaboration, except perhaps the people who are most invested and benefiting from an individualistic workplace.
Yeah.
You know, so we have to be clear, there are some people today who are those individual heroes. And they're getting paid better because they take all the credit. They're getting ego gratification because people do hold them up as the knight in shining armor. So those people will stand to lose. But at the end of the day, I think it's probably a sacrifice worth making.
Yeah. But is there a way to accommodate those people?
Absolutely. So I was on the phone this morning with the CEO of a big global company that is trying to figure out exactly that.
Okay.
So, I have to be careful. there is a reorganization coming about where they will join together different divisions so that those divisions work more collaboratively to serve their customers. The heads of those two divisions right now are likely to lose their title because neither of them would be the chief of the joined up divisions. And so the question is, what can they get instead? And it comes down to a really personalized analysis of what do they want. One of those division leaders is only a few years away from retirement, and his objective is legacy. He doesn't want to be seen as the person who got pushed aside as the old guy. So it's really important, and he's not just egotistic that way. He also cares very deeply about this business that he's been helping to build for decades. And he wants to make sure that his people will be taken care of and so forth. So he cares about his own ego, but he also cares about his people. And so how do you help him understand that his legacy in supporting this unified new company is going to be better than it would have been if he was just the king of a piece of it? It's entirely possible through the role that he gets, probably giving him continuing his role on the management committee, helping him sustain some of the status that he has now, and helping him transition into the kind of role where he's seen as the elder statesman. Mm. He doesn't need to be the operator anymore. He's proven that he can do that. Mm. He's led this the growth. Da, da, da. Now, what's the next chapter? Mm. His counterpart is a young gun. Mm. Needs to have the experience of growing fast. Da, 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 da. What do you do with that guy? Mm. Okay, well, he's not actually equipped to run this joined up division. He's too junior. He's unproven. He probably doesn't have the right capabilities. He doesn't have the following. So what kind of a role do you craft for him? Mm. And in the new collaborative environment, he could play a strong leadership role in motivating people and really establishing true leadership, creating a followership, using his strengths in things like data and analytics to get the organization to the next level. But he's probably better positioned as something like a COO. And it could, for both of those individuals, this joined up collaborative organization could be exactly the platform that they would want. But the CEO needs to paint a picture of what that looks like and be hyper aware of those two very different individuals and what their motivations are. So my
team, sounds like a challenge.
It's a real challenge, but it's a puzzle. Even though we're talking about human beings, you can use real analysis here to understand what these people want, and ideally a lot of dialogue and empathy with them to co-create a future which they find not just acceptable, but wildly attractive. But it can't be forced on them.
No.
And it's absolutely not one size fits all. And this human touch is where leaders, great leaders, are much better, because at the end of the day, it's more important to focus your efforts in a change, in a transformation on, well, it's more important to focus, period. The problem that we often see when we're working with leaders that are trying to make a transformation happen is that they focus on the wrong part of the organization. So there's almost always like a bell curve of commitment to a new idea. There's the group of people who are the resistors or the skeptics, and they're usually not as big as anyone thinks that they are. There's a equally small group of people who are excited for change because they're visionary or the system isn't working for them or whatever. But then there's a big lump of people in the middle who just don't know. They're probably satisfied enough with the status quo that it feels comfortable for them. They don't want to take a lot of risks, but at the same time, they're open to being won over. And the trouble we see is most leaders fight the wrong battles. They focus their efforts on the resistors. How do we win them over? It's very unlikely that you take somebody who's extremely resistant to change and turn them into a champion. At best, you move them into the wait and see camp. Instead, I'm encouraging like this CEO to figure out who's already a champion for this and how does he use those people to carry the flag. Because a number of those people have strong influence in the organization, or at least the potential for influence. And so getting them to start working on that big group in the middle and pulling some people into the supporter camp is really important. And I don't mean just in a purely political sense. I mean, you know, having those people who are close to the action, understanding where the opportunities are and starting to tell these stories about when we're already operating like this new vision looks like, so that people can say, oh, wait a minute, it's not so different. We're doing that already. Mm. We're just doing it a little bit, and now we wouldn't need to do it consistently. Mm. And so leaders need to think really carefully about how they focus their efforts and where they focus their efforts in a transformation. And it's often counterintuitive when we start talking about focus your efforts on the people who are positive, because the thinking is often, well, they're already, we won them over, we can leave them alone. Mm. It's like, no, they're your best hope for making this transformation happen.
And there's no danger in letting the skeptics be. I mean,
there is danger, right? Yeah. So you can't ignore them. You just can't spend all your time and energy there.
Because it takes too much energy.
It takes too much energy, and you're never going to make champions out of them.
Yeah.
So really what you're trying to think about is how to neutralize them.
Yeah.
And some of them probably have very legitimate concerns. Mm. So you don't want to put them all in the, oh, they're so stupid, they can't see the future, they're just dinosaurs. That's a huge mistake as well. Engage with them and understand what their fear is. Mm. And maybe some of those fears are legitimate, and the leader hearing those is really helpful, because you know you want to safeguard the organization so those fears don't come true. Mm. So engaging with them to understand their position is really helpful. Mm. If they have legitimate fears, it may be that they get neutralized by helping to work on averting the worst case scenario. Mm. And then they still won't believe that it's roses and unicorns and rainbows, but they at least will realize that it's not a disaster.
Yeah.
If there are people in that camp who really are just dinosaurs, or they're incredibly selfish and they don't want to share the rewards with people and so forth, those are the ones that are very hard to even neutralize.
Yeah.
And the question then is, how do you keep them from doing damage?
Yeah.
Okay. So you put them in the damage control as opposed to the win them over.
Yeah. Okay. And like, I don't know if it's possible to be that like pragmatic, but can you talk me through the how to? Like, what is the first step a boss, like or a leader or management, need to take in order to break down silos?
Yeah.
Like, if you can give an example. Is it defining the goal?
The first step, I think, is defining the goal.
Yeah.
What could we do better?
Yeah.
And better means different things, right? It could be faster innovation. It could be more profitable business. Yeah. It could be in the nonprofit world. You know, I mean, I was yesterday, I don't know if I'm allowed to talk about this, but we had lunch with some people from UN Ops, right? Mm-hmm. And their goal is not profit. Their goal is to break even because they're a fee-for-service organization. But their goal is to equip the field operations of the UN in the best possible way, with the best staff, the best training, etc. So in that case, what could they do if they broke down silos? Frame it in terms of the goals that they want to achieve. So absolutely defining the goal. One thing that we do with companies is often quantify the upside. And so we run the numbers and we say, here's how much, say in revenue terms, here's how much revenue you're generating when you're siloed, and here's how much revenue you're generating when you're collaborative. Mm. Do a thought experiment. Mm. How, like if you shifted 10% of your customers from siloed to collaborative, how much revenue would that generate incrementally? When we run those numbers, it's massive. Tens of millions of whatever currency. People go, oh my God, like that's a lot of money we're leaving on the table.
Yeah.
Right? So sometimes painting the financial upside and really saying, this is not out of bounds aspirational. This is entirely doable.
Yeah.
Now what do we have to do to get there?
Yeah.
So that kind of goal, quantified or strategic, is really helpful. And then we have this whole process laid out to figure out where do you run some pilots to figure out the how-tos. Mm. So first it's the what are we trying to achieve, and then in the how-tos, it's where I'm such a strong advocate of collecting some data and making sure leaders get a realistic picture of where those barriers are and where it's working well. So finding those replicable bright spots is really crucial, because it will allow leaders to build on existing success stories and make it less uncertain for people. It will allow them to see that this is realistic, because we're already doing it 10 times. Now we just need to do it 1,000 times. And finding those oftentimes unheralded successes. They often come out of corners of the organization that people thought were doing fine, but when you dig into it, you realize there's just so much more potential there that's getting blocked because it had to stay small because of these structural barriers or whatever. And then you can do the, well, what would it take to make that bigger, more consistent, more frequent, touch more customers, involve more employees, those sorts of things. And so this toolkit that we've developed and has now just been released gives people a pretty easy process that they can follow to dig into it. And, you know, we've given them step by step by step. Here's the data to collect. Here's the way you set up the survey. Here's how you analyze it. Here's the path forward. If it says this, then do that. And we've tried to make it as turnkey as possible so that people take an objective approach to figuring out how to go about doing this.
Okay. I think that was what I wanted to ask you, actually. Is there something I haven't touched on that you think is important to say?
I mean, there are a lot of things. We could go on and on for
hours, I guess.
You know,
So, I think one of the points that I always want to emphasize, and I did it last night, so you've heard it before, but this idea that collaboration is not a soft skill and it can't be left to HR. Because as soon as it is delegated to a support function, it tends to get undervalued. And so this is really an issue that should be addressed at the executive levels and even the board levels. You know, the one chapter we wrote and didn't include in the book was about smarter collaboration for corporate boards or boards of directors more generally. And they are a microcosm of what we're talking about, because every person on a board, ideally, bring something different to that board. And a board's effectiveness hinges on its ability to draw out all of that differential professional experience and use it for the sake of the organization. Boards are often pretty dysfunctional. And so, yeah, I think I'd emphasize that this is the opposite of the kind of problem that can be pushed aside in an organization. It can be pushed down in the sense of empowering people, but it needs very strong leadership at the executive levels and ultimately at the board level too. Because this is a point of sustainability and differentiation, and that's what boards are supposed to be about.